G'day, I'm Leon Compton and welcome to the guest room at ABC Local Online. I hope you enjoy the download and don't forget you can hear the guest room live from 11 a.m. each weekday on 105.7 ABC Darwin and 783 Alice Springs.
Right, the guest room here with you, Melinda James here with you for the next hour with a very special guest. Our guest today pretty much spans the life spectrum in her work. She's a childhood and adolescent specialist, a marriage and funeral celebrant, and a palliative carer. Birth, death and marriage and everything in between. What interests me though are her thoughts on parenting, how to raise kids so that they grow into beautiful, fully functioning people. And to oversimplify her thinking, it seems to be eat more dirt, metaphorically as well as literally. Although it is a little more complicated than that, she has some very interesting things to say about raising children and raising children now in particular. She's got four sons of her own to practice on, and I wouldn't be surprised if she conducted her own wedding. We'll find out after her first musical selection. Our guest today, Maggie Dench. What a beautiful, beautiful song. That was If I Were Brave by Sean Colvin, beautifully sung as well. And it's the first musical selection of my guest this morning, Maggie Dent. Good morning, Maggie.
Good morning, Melinda.
Oh, I think this next hour is going to be an absolute pleasure. But tell me about that song. I've never heard it before.
That's I like songs that actually allow us to reflect and that's, you know, and I like it, you know, that we have all these songs on the radio of how desperately awful it is to break up and fall madly in love. But I think sometimes we need to step back and look at our life as a bigger picture. And I think, you know, that song captures that for me, that there are times that if I was braver, I would have made different decisions. And but it's okay. It's actually okay. It's the living of life, I think. That's what that brings up for me. Just live it. You know, sometimes we're great, sometimes we're lousy, and that's life, that there's no perfect. And I hope that's what the listeners get from that at times. You know, it's just turning up and having another go.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, Maggie, before we get on to the work you do now, let's have a bit of a chat about your own story, because in some ways you did the perfect apprenticeship in how not to bring up kids and adolescents. Now tell us about where you grew up in Wandering, just south of Perth. Tell us about that community and how your parents came to be there.
Absolutely. I'm very proud, a very proud bushy, so I call myself a scrubber from the bush. My folks are farmers, sheep wheat farmers, just in this little tiny town village. No, you couldn't even really call it that. It's just a street called Wandering. And I'm the sort of tail end of a large family. I'm the fifth of six. My grandparents lived on the farm, and my aunt and uncle were sort of over the river not far away. So very much a sense of family.
Family would have been your world, really.
It was. And I look back at it, and even though my mum was an alcoholic and not terribly well and emotionally completely unavailable for us as children, so that was really a tough part of my childhood. But because I needed to escape to survive, well, I spent, you know, eons of time out in the bush, connected to the land. So I'm a complete earth child. You know, I just, in my imaginary world, I could talk to the sheep and I could talk to the trees and the sky, and I had my favourite rocks. And I actually filled myself as a child with a great sense of peace and joy in nature. And then with all these siblings, we just ran amok on 4,000 acres and 10,000 sheep.
And as so bush kids actually can do in such a wonderful
absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. And it is a really important thing, and as I've done the research on what raises healthy children, we had the great capacity to develop our seeking mechanism in our brain, which is a curiosity of children. It wasn't stunted down by, you know, being kept indoors or being kept over-controlled or kept or distracted by TV. We just, it was out there. And, yeah, there were times we did things that were pretty dangerous and learned how to survive. So, you know, that's great. And then afterwards, we also had to work on the farm. You know, from a very early age, we had to be responsible. You just couldn't wander off because you got tired. you had to keep rounding up sheep till they were all in, or you had to keep helping with the bushfires till it was all done, or you had to keep... We used to wash the bags that the super came in a river and dry them on fences, because that's actually what the grain was bagged into before we had silos. And it was really physical work, but, God, jings, we had fun at the same time, dunking each other in the river and all the things that I think are healthy for children.
And that are possibly missing from childhoods these days. But I'd like to get on to that, how your childhood relates to how you think children should be raised these days. But you did mention something there when you were talking about your parents, and you said that your mother was an alcoholic and was emotionally unavailable to you. Yeah. Now, it seems that you sought and found solace in the landscape. Was it not the same for your mum? Did she was she isolated there in that small town?
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. She was a Sydneysider. Can you imagine that?
Right.
Falling in love with my dad as a sailor on the wharf at, in Sydney, and coming all the way across to go into a town. And on the farm at the time when Mum arrived, there was no running water. Mm. So you can imagine the cultural thing. But Mum wasn't, didn't have an outgoing personality. She was a very solo lady. And I secretly think she probably had postnatal depression for, you know, six children, was never diagnosed. Very low social skills and no friends, you know. And as a woman, you know, when I finally got to the age as my mum was when she was breeding as well, I got a whole different view of what it was like. And then imagine having a child like me. I mean, I asked a million questions and drove her completely mad. No wonder she used to say, get outside and shut up, because we're not easy to raise, you know. And I had an older brother very like me. No wonder we wore it out. Terribly, terribly horrible children we were.
Was your relationship with her similar to the relationships your siblings had with her?
No, only that I guess in a way the other one that I call us roosters, we're sort of very strong characters. My older brother and I, we copped a lot more of the beltings than the others, but we would stand up and, you know, and try and say why you like this and don't do this. The others, totally different. You know, I think in every single childhood, and this is what everyone needs to realise, we all get damaged. You know, there's no perfect parents. You know, if we were able to give what every child needed, you couldn't possibly have a job or have other children. Mm. So we need everyone to know. And I used to think, you know, my childhood with my mum was really bad. But once I became a counsellor, oh, my God, it disappeared. What other people have to live with was way, way worse. So it's how we form our story. And then when we get older, you know, do we need to keep running that story? And that's what I realised as I got older. I thought, oh, my God, that story's not happening now. My mum did the best she could. She really did with what she had and what she knew, which wasn't a lot. And probably she's probably a sort of woman who should never have had children, because she really wasn't maternal. And that's just how life is. There are some women who aren't, and there are some who are, you know, probably too maternal. So
and
in
to
that
be
journey
not
when
maternal,
I got to that place.
Yeah, and go
absolutely.
On to have six kids in a very
six
small town
kids.
When you're not a naturally gregarious or resourceful person.
And not creative. She didn't really have the outlet. So, you know, that side of it, And when I got to that point, it was beautiful, because my mum and I reconnected very much as I got older, because I really got rid of the anger I had as a child and realised, you know, we're just all journeying. And she was really significant in my life, because she taught me how not to be a mum.
You spoke with her about this?
We did early on, and every time I brought it up, she was terribly, terribly distressed with it. So I thought, no, this is just my stuff. And I felt I needed to leave her with that. But when I'd actually moved on from it, and I needed to do some work, because I was a very angry child and kept people away, I actually became safer. She knew I was actually safer. So in those later years, she did end up in sort of alcohol-induced dementia kind of thing. She'd come out every now and then. But I was a safe person in her life, which, I just know that she's looking after me. She's obviously not here on this planet anymore. But there are times I can feel her when I'm in my garden, and I know what she'd say to me about what I'm doing, because she was a really avid gardener, and I got my love of gardening from my mum. And also, she was a great cook.
How important do you think it was that you, in a sense, forgave your mum? What kind of a person would you be if you hadn't have done that, do you think?
Well, look, huge. And I know that, and that's partly what sort of drove me in the end to become a counsellor and work with adolescents, because my journey in adolescence was to be an aloof kind of bitch. In other words, nobody could see, because on the inside, if you don't sort of feel loved or treasured at some point as a child, you can feel that you're not enough, not good enough. And I definitely felt that. So it was huge when I finally got to the point where I realised it actually happened to the others in the family in different ways. I wasn't the only one who was damaged. And everyone is in a way. I thought, oh, gosh, we'll just get on with it. And I could make choices then. And also when I got rid of some of the anger I had inside me, my dad was quite a joyful soul with a terrible sense of humour. So my cheeky fun side came out. So it's almost like the more we hold on to toxic feelings, I think, the more we can't bring in the honey into the honey pot. So, yeah, it was a beautiful gift. Once I got rid of that, I found laughter and love for my mum and for actually myself too, which was really huge.
Well, I was going to ask you about your father. Where was he in all this? Your dad was
hiding out
in
the paddock with us.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was just his way of coping. Being farmers, they're gone every morning by 7 anyway. And I know at times when we were going around the sheep, I used to think, Dad, why are we going around the sheep? We were around the sheep yesterday and they're not lambing. So why are we? He's always just keeping an eye on things. But I really think it was just a way to keep out the house, you know. Mm. And then it's morning tea time, of course, and then lunch and then afternoon tea and then, you know. It's a big job being a farmer's wife. And so I guess she did all the obligatory things very, very well. It was just the loving and the nurturing. And also I'm a highly kinesthetic child person, which means safe touch is really important to me. So obviously not getting that was almost worse than anything else my mum could have done, you know.
So I have no very physical little memories. Affection?
No physical, never physical affection. And that's something that I know drives a lot of really aggressive behaviour sometimes in children, is that just if they're a kinesthetic and that need's not being met, then they will actually want to demand it from the world, and that's we get it in all sorts of other ways. But, yeah, it's a simple thing.
Mm. For your mum to have been a city girl and decide to move her life across the continent to be with this man, they must have had a love of some sort to begin
mad passionate love, and I'm the only one in the family she shared that with, and we shared it, you know. She just told me that, you know, she was actually in a cigarette booth, you'll love this, and a bunch of sailors walked past and she spotted my dad in this group of men and said to the bird that was working with her, she said, I'm going to marry that man one day, he's the man for me. And it was two or three nights later that they went to one of the dances that are put on for the sailors and met Dad, and they did, they fell absolutely. Mum said even you know, they got married and then she was pregnant. Dad went away for another 8 or 9 months. My sister was born. So she came all the way across on a train down to this backward place. And also my grandparents were Protestant and she was Catholic. Can you imagine? I mean, that's gutsy stuff. Most of us nowadays just pack up and say, I'm not doing this. Mm. And even, you know, she said at times they were just so in love, you know, and in those early years. And you can see it in the photos and things.
It speaks volumes about that kind of mad, passionate love that a person who you describe as being socially awkward and not very outgoing and someone who eventually retreated into alcoholism to deal with life would make such a brave decision.
Oh, Eros is a powerful thing. I hope you've fallen in love and had a good dose of it, Melinda.
I should have. Sanity. You might be listening. He's all right. We get on all right.
It is. There are degrees of it, and it definitely is sort of something that would pull two people who are so different.
Can inspire people to do marvellous things.
Absolutely. And really, you know, we've got an amazing bunch. My siblings are all amazing human beings. Amazing.
But did that love between them last? Your father obviously saw your mother.
Yeah.
I'm assuming from what you've been saying that there was some sort of downward spiral as her coping.
Well, no, it's the getting on with life. I think that generation, and I think a lot of people listening whose parents were that sort of generation after the war, you just got on with things. You didn't actually have a great feminist movement at the time that meant women had anything to do other than raise children, look after men. And the farming culture is particularly strong like that. You know, you just serve the men. And they work extremely hard. So it was a kind of agreement. And they did have it. You know, their life was great. They play golf together. They, you know, the same sort of social. But that's the thing Mum started to do. When she started to play golf and they actually created more outward and all of us got older, I think their life was actually, it sort of went drowned in children and work and then came back later. And their later years, you know, they've travelled overseas together and had holidays together and stuff. And I could see them still journeying together, definitely. You know, it didn't have a lot of bells and whistles, but a very, very comfortable kind of space, which I think says a lot. You know, today I think maybe we just pack up and move out if we haven't got the bells and whistles. And I think sometimes, you know, we think the grass might be green on the other side, but I know that there was just a sense of comfort and Mum cared for Dad beautifully. Absolutely beautifully. And he could work and do all the things he needed to. He was the social guy. He was the shy president and captain of everything, and Mum was the background. And I think sometimes in that generation, that worked. It might not be what would suit us, but it worked for them.
So even if your relationship with your mum wasn't one that gave you the best foundation for life, maybe their relationship was a good model for you for romantic relationships into the future? For yourself?
Definitely the falling in love stuff, definitely. Mm. And also the knowing how that we can give and take and share and hang in there when things get tough. Mum would anchor and stand beside Dad if he had a stroke when he was about 52, and it was the first time I'd ever seen my dad in bed in pyjamas because farmers get out of bed so early. It was quite funny. But I remember afterwards just how much Mum stood beside him to make sure he got well, and I really loved that sense of strong, unquestioned loyalty that I witnessed, definitely.
Did he recover?
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah, bounced back. Stopped drinking 48,000 cups of coffee and smoking and stressing. And it was a wake-up call of lots of things, you know, really profound. My dad actually grew up on a farm with a one-teacher school, but ended up in Albany Senior High School, which is a very large school down the bottom, and ended up winning awards for when he did his final leaving or tertiary admittance exams. Absolutely gifted at English. And he did actually go off and become an ag scientist, but never wrote anything creatively until that stroke at 52. And he wrote something about the mornings of my life, and he reflected on mornings on the farm and the mornings when he was in the war as a sailor off the ships off Borneo, and obviously the morning that the tea trolley went rattling up the hospital corridors. And I suddenly thought, my gosh, you know, I know he's been a farmer all these years, but there's this amazing ability and gift in my dad that I've never seen. And fortunately, that brought it out, and we've all got a piece of this beautiful poetry that he wrote.
Oh, how fantastic.
I hope to think that's what comes through me. Every now and then I think, oh, my God, where'd I get this gift to be able to write? And I hope it's my dad. I hope that influence has come from him.
Maggie Dent. Now, Maggie, let's talk about when you did enter the big wide world just briefly. It was after school and a stint at boarding school, off to university.
Yep.
How did you find university?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. For a bush kid and earth kid, that was just the transition from hell for me. Obviously, coming with a low self-esteem on the inside and yet quite capable on the outside, I was a bit of an enigma. You know, school captain, high grades, captain, you know, played really good sports. So everyone on the outside thought, what a capable, confident girl. On the inside, I just felt like a pile of muck. I mean, I got to the boarding place over the road from University of Western Australia, and first the noise of the traffic nearly killed my head every night. I just couldn't believe the noise, you know, because I've come from not even hearing a car drive past our farm some days. And then I had all these sort of horrid experiences within a short space of time to really push me to the edge. Mugged in the underpass, I was at a basketball party and saw people shooting up with tourniquets and things. I'd never experienced any drugs at all in my life. Mm. I had somebody try and break in my room. Lesbians propositioned me, you name it. It pushed every single scary button for a conservative farm kid you can imagine.
From zero to 100 really, k's an hour.
I know, totally. And then there's university where really they don't really give a poop. It wasn't as nurturing as school. Mm. And then finally, the worst, the scariest bit was I'd never failed anything in my life because I was quite intelligent. And I failed my first essay sort of like, you know, about 6 or 8 weeks after all these things were happening, and I was obviously being attacked at every angle. And I only got 46, so it wasn't terrible. It was an essay on the Senate, which I'm really glad because I never went into politics after that. Hmm. And then what happened is it just cracked my mask, and my mask was hanging on a hook that said, I have worth and value because I'm clever and because I can do English and write well. And it just cracked, and I walked back from the university, and I thought, my goodness, and I could hear in my head was my mum was right. I'm actually just never going to amount to anything. I'm just useless, and I'm hopeless, and I don't want to live like this. I don't want to be like this. And I went back to my room, and I swallowed a whole bottle of pills within, you know, 15 minutes, and I really wanted to kill myself. And one of them broke on the back of my tooth, and I threw up and vomited it up. And I remember at that point thinking, I had no one, and that's sometimes what children of alcoholic families do is they keep people away. They look like you've got friends, but you don't let anyone ever come really close. And I didn't have anybody I could call. You know, we didn't have mobile phones, other than I said, but I didn't have anyone I could reach out to and say, oh, my goodness, I failed my politics success. I feel like I couldn't do that because I couldn't let anyone know how vulnerable I was, and it nearly was the end of me.
Mm. How did you recover from that?
It was really interesting, and that's why at different times I talk when I'm working with adolescents, and that's one of the other. That's the sensitivity of the adolescent brain. And now I know with all the studies, you know, that's how sensitive it is, can make dumb decisions really quickly. I remember laying there and there was snot and there was sort of like, you know, vomit and there was, you know, tears, and I was curled in a fetal position thinking, oh, and I remember that a ray of sunshine came in through the window and warmed me, and I don't know, and it's just one of those things you can't explain, you know, so that's why I got the song I Believe with the King, because something touched me then that wasn't human, that wasn't on this planet, that gave me hope, that let me know I wasn't alone. And I remember thinking, oh, very clearly after this, within ninoseconds of the warmth of the sun, thinking, I'm not meant to die. I'm not meant to die yet. I've got something I need to do. And it just gave me this shift in me that I changed from journalism and went to do teaching. And I realized that's where I needed to be, because I understood adolescent kids. I understood the games we play in our head, and I understood the desperate despair and the need to be liked. And then that sent me off on that journey. Absolute vulnerability. And that's, it's driving. And I'm actually about to, I've just finished writing my book on adolescence. It's taken me 30 years to get around to putting it on paper, because today's kids are even more vulnerable than I was. I wasn't getting scrambled with, you know, things in my ears and how many friends on Facebook and mobile phones and texting and ghastly programs that devalue humans and especially females. I didn't have any of that, and I struggled.
Mm.
So I know that they're even more vulnerable and even more at risk. And so that is what drives my work. You know, I actually love adolescence. I love the farting, burping, mm-hmm. you know, unpredictable kind of behaviour of them, because I just understand it. I really, really get it. And I'm glad I haven't lost it since then. Having raised four sons, I'm really good at some of the antics, that particularly of our boys and those sorts of things. And I think that's partly what I'm on the planet to do, is help other people understand them better so they don't need to do what I did, to feel there's no one there.
Well, let's talk about your work after this song. We'll play a song first and then talk about your work, because you say you understand adolescence. Many of us, even though of course we were once one, find them incredibly perplexing and confusing.
Yes.
So we'll talk about that after this. Maggie Dent, my guest this morning, her next musical selection. Bob Seger there with Night Moves on ABC Local Radio, right around the Northern Territory. It's about 22 minutes to 12, and you're listening to The Guest Room on ABC Local Radio, and our guest this morning, Maggie Dent. Now, Maggie, that song has a particular story attached to it, doesn't it, that relates to the work you've done with teenagers?
Totally. That 1978, I was in Albany Senior High School, and these Year 12s were... I just had the most amazing group. All my classes were fabulous. But this particular bunch, we just stepped them forward. I just don't know what it was. But you've got to remember, I was only 23 and they're 17. So it's really scary, because they're about 48 at the moment. You know, that's frightening, isn't it, that students I taught are that old. And they gave me this LP when I left, and it anchored in so amazing. I've just been sitting here flooding with the memories of these kids, and it was years later that I moved that year. I went to Perth and taught in a really, really challenging school in Perth, and I didn't actually get to know what their results were, and it was years later that I found that they got the most exceptional results, you know, like and that was because we were able to create this amazing, amazing classroom where we got them enthusiastic about themselves and learning, and that's what we need in our classrooms, people who let them believe in themselves before they do the learning. And
so how did you do that?
Well, besides the fact I really love adolescents, which shows they know when you don't really like them, I guess I questioned what brings out the best in kids, and I knew that the better they felt about themselves. So I actually went, my very first year out, I photocopied a lot of pages out of Jack Canfield's book, 101 Ways to Build Self-Esteem in the Classroom, and I built that in, that we needed to also make sure that we had a communication. So I wanted feedback from then about how I was going and what worked, and not many people were brave enough in those days to do that. And they gave me fabulous feedback about what worked, and so I was just able to build on strength after strength after strength, and also be able to get them to think. I was sort of, even those days, it's not easy for them to think. If they haven't been made to think, they can just be unable to make a conviction. Well, you can't write well in English, especially at high levels, without knowing what you believe. So that was the journey, is helping students to think and explore that through their writing, and also having writing that you didn't have to mark, so that they could be brave and say what they really thought, not just what they thought they needed to get a good mark.
Why do you think adults are scared of adolescents? Because they are.
Totally. And I hope, that people listening can remember what the adolescent... I call it a bumpy ride. It's a bumpy ride from childhood to adulthood, and it's supposed to be bumpy for lots of reasons. We now know, that the brain does some serious brain pruning. So what was actually quite stable at 12 is very unstable at 13 to 14 to 16, to even coming back online a little bit at 18. So they're actually unpredictable. And the part of their brain, the prefrontal, that makes them make really sound decisions and mature choices and plan and control their impulses doesn't finish developing to the 20s. So they're not good with impulses. And they say dumb things, do dumb things, are rude, are inappropriate, and make the most incredibly stupid choices around their lives. And, of course, people want them to be well-behaved and compliant, because they're so much easier to control. But I'd be, seriously worried, because we know that we're developing the brain into being a mature brain. So the unpredictability and the scatteredness and the stretching out to the edge of wanting to be different or desperately trying to be the same as everyone else so no one notices me are all healthy adolescent development. But it's bumpy. It's very bumpy. And there is a risk, that some of these things can be fatal, some of the choices they make.
You mentioned you moved to Perth to work at a particularly challenging school. Yeah. How did you break through to those teenagers? And tell us what they were like.
It's just amazing. I mean, mainstream, most kids are pretty much the same. I'd like to say that. So when I went to this, at-risk, tough school, I pulled up the first time and there were barbed wire all around the perimeter of the school. And I thought, oh, my God.
To keep them in.
Yeah, to keep them in the daytime and out at night. The principal sort of took me in and said, oh, look, we're giving you the at-riskier 10s. They're really animals. They're just animals. You won't be able to teach them any. Just keep them in the classroom, will you? And we're giving you the really bright year 9s. We've got 40 of those in each of these classes, and then the 11s and the 12s. And so I just, I've not good at city consciousness. And I remember getting back to my office and feeling really a bit uneasy, and I realised I was angry at him for being so disrespectful about these kids, these at-risk ones I was having, until I met them, I suppose, for the first couple of days.
And so resigned to their fate.
Absolutely. So if we don't hold hope, they have none. Mm. We're the lighthouses that guide them, and if we're not there to do that, then they have no hope. And I wasn't prepared to do that. And there was about sort of 20 of them. They came from all the cultural backgrounds. They actually were all in gangs. Staggered in the room, chewing gum, and F was every second word that they ever said, and they had such low literacy rates. So as an English teacher, what the heck am I supposed to do? I thought I might give them some life skills, but like following road maps and finding telephone numbers, you can't do that without an alphabet. And I, that was a journey. I thought, now how can I give them something that's relevant? Because that's the big thing in adolescence, is what are you going to teach me relevant for me? And then can you make it interesting? And then can you make it worthwhile? So I figured a lot of them said at one point that they had Monaros in their garages because they came from migrant families, and their parents had already got them a Monaro for when they turned 17. They're only 15.
Yeah, right.
Because they wanted them to have what they didn't have, and I thought, my God, these kids on the road. Oh, my God, I can't give them a lesson about, driving carefully if you can't get to the point of where are their values. So I thought I'd organise a visit out to the Paraquad Centre at Shenton Park, to see if I could show them the consequences of some decision-making. And when I went to the principal, he said, no.
So what was this, a residential care place for people?
Yeah, it's where you go after rehab. It's the rehab centre. So sometimes you're actually still in a ward laying down because you're paralysed from the neck down. Mm-hmm. But often you're in rehab learning how to move and walk again. And they were fabulous. They thought that was going to be... Anyway, my principal said, no, you're not taking those animals out of the school. I'm not letting you go. I won't cover your insurance. And so that's at different times, we have to step up and give these kids a chance because, they've been written off forever, that you can't trust them. So I went to a higher, level of the education department and fortunately met a really wise, lovely, compassionate leader. And she said, no, I'll back you. I'll cover it. And it was a really scary trip for me. I didn't sleep the night before because these kids had flick knives. They were slashing, uniforms and, they were really, they could be scary. So I was a bit nervous about the bus. Anyway, the bus that turned up from Transperth MTT in those days, instead of being just a normal bus, because I only had 20, for some reason they sent a joined-in-the-middle Mercedes with leather seats. And those buses never ever went out near this suburb. And they're all going, oh, look at the bus she's got for us. Hey, that's awesome. I go, oh, my God. You know, there's part of me that went, oh, my God, what are they going to do with the seats? Anyway, the day, they were absolutely modelled. They were well-behaved. They got there. And when they were, and I warned them that these kids' language is rough, that's the only code they know. And, you know, they went through the workshop area and, you know, they were just chat. They got, remember, their prefrontals are even less developed because they don't have what's appropriate, what's polite. And then they were talking to the young people who were paralysed. And I remember a couple of the boys gathered around these two young guys and they found out one was a motorbike accident and one had jumped off a groin in the dark, drunk. Another was, on the other side, was a car accident, which is what I wanted to get through to them. This is what can happen if we don't take responsibility. Mm. Anyway, and of course, they're just those sort of kids. And one of them sort of said to the other, said, oh, so how do you crap? You know, because they don't have that, you know. And of course, the guys looked at, should we tell them? And I said, yeah, well, somebody has to do it for us manually. So we sort of get back raked. Well, if face just hit the ground, you know. And then, of course, the next thing would have to be for a 14-year-old is you still get a stiffy. Yeah. And no, that's gone forever. And I went, oh, no, really, you know, like anchored in really big time. Chatted with them and were really okay. They helped to sort of blow it into wheelchairs and they drove a car with no, you know, foot controls and very quiet on the way back in the bus. And the next day, the ones who could write, by then I could get them working in groups. It was quite amazing when you pull the walls down between, because kids are all just wanting to be okay and safe. And a couple of them were missing, and I was really disappointed. I said, where are they? I said, oh, no, they're coming. I thought, something's up. They're all looking at each other. Something's up. And they came in about 15 minutes later. Now, they had this massive big bouquet of flowers.
Oh.
And I looked at them and said, what's this for? You don't need to do that. We worked out, no one's ever trusted us. This is the first excursion we've ever been on, and we just want to say thank you. And I obviously burst into tears. And I realised then that, you know, if I'd given up on them, then, you know, they don't have those opportunities where they can learn to be trusted. And we just had this amazing year with this one particular group. And more things happened to the students in that year. You know, they just wouldn't believe the violence, the drug use, the incest, the... And yet, underneath it, they just wanted to come and be treated like they were okay and someone smile at them and treat them with respect. So it was a life-changing year for me because it really pushed me to the edge of what are we as teachers about? And they may not have got high grades, those kids, in that year, but I knew that they knew. I ended up doing the next social experiment with them was to teach them how to go out for dinner because I felt there's a life skill there. If you don't know how to act appropriately, people are going to think you're a yobbo or, you know, idiot. So I did the same thing again, I had done French at school, so we did it, pretend we're going to go to a French restaurant, so we'd set up the room and I'd do simple French and which instruments, and, you know, no smoking while you don't smoke while people are, you know, eating, and etiquette. And then at the very end of the year, we took them out. I went to a French restaurant with this bunch of kids. It was actually in the Hay Street Mall, which is right in the centre of the city, very nervous. And yet they were just model students, and they kept going, get your elbows off the table, don't smoke now. And afterwards, the guy sort of gave me too much change, and I couldn't work out what that was about. So I thought, oh, there's enough here for an ice cream for the lot of us. So I went down the mall, and there's an ice cream place. And as I'm walking down, one of the Macedonian kids said, hey, miss, come over here. And it took me down a dark alley to meet his mates. And I must admit, the part of me went, and then I realised I couldn't have been safer because these kids have all heard about me. Mm. And they all said hello. And then I was dragged down another alley to meet the Italian ones and down another alley for the Aboriginal kids. And then we all sat along the curb and I looked along at these kids that were told at the beginning of the year that they were animals. And we were all sharing ice creams and they were sitting in amongst each other. And that's when I realised, you know, I had an enormous lump in my throat and I realised we're just kids. I just want people to help guide them, care about them. You know, and that was really what I guess drives a lot of my work is that we're just not looking at what the outside says and know that inside there is a spirit that needs to be fed by kindness and compassion rather than shaming and blaming and criticising and judging.
Well, most people usually have a favourite teacher who stands out in their memory, and I'm sure you're probably that person for a lot of your students. But as teachers, you probably have some standout students as well who feature prominently.
Yeah.
In your memory, do you have any in particular who...
Oh, endless. And I, you know, there were times just, you know, it's just amazing. And some of them were little things. And that's what I keep saying to people. We don't know how small the influence may be because you may just say something little in passing, but it may be very profound for the kids. And one of them was this particular... I use this in my workshops with adolescents because I want them to know that... you often feel dumb when the brain prunes itself. So sort of 13 to 15, you feel really stupid. And you stop actually engaging in schoolwork because you think you're really dumb, because you get forgetful and all sorts of things that the brain does to you that you didn't know it was doing. And I had this boy, Chris, messing around one day, and eventually I was going to speak to him and he took off. And I thought, you know, because you get that look on your face as a teacher, you want to speak to a student. Anyway, as I walked to the car, my car, I noticed that he was actually marching with Sea Cadets, which is kind of cadet unit, and he was marching with incredible discipline. I thought, oh, my goodness, he can have that discipline, but not in my classroom. And I thought, oh, it's obviously me. I need to smarten up a little. Anyway, I let him go for a few days and tried a few different things. It wasn't working. I had a little chat with him, and I sat down and said, Chris, I'm a bit worried about your behaviour, mate. And he said, yeah, it's pretty bad, eh? And I said, yeah, and you're not handing any work in, so you're not doing very well. Yeah, no, pretty useless, eh? And I said, you know, I'm just letting you know that in WA it's kind of like year nine. It's the last year you can muck around, because year 10 you've got to start getting grades to get to TAFE or uni or whatever. And he said, oh, no, miss, I'm dumb. And I said, I don't know that you are dumb. And he said, no, I'm really dumb. And I said, no, and every now and then you say something intelligent. And he said, I think you might have a brain. And he went, do you? Really? I said, yeah, I think you might have a brain. And he said, far out, I said. And I said, so what do you think next year, particularly? Put your head down. And that was the year I went off to the Perth school, so I wasn't there the next year. Now, it's 15 years later that his sister comes to a retreat I'm running for women, and she hands me this printed email and says, so this is from Chris. And I got this flash of this boy, because he was a bit cheeky. And in the email said something like, dear Mrs. Dent, I hope you remember me and that conversation you had with me in year nine. Now, the conversation took 2.5 minutes. Mm. But he said, you know, I took it on board. He said, and next year I put my head down. You were right. I did have a brain. He said, I went on to university and I got 2 PhDs. And I'm now one of the highest qualified submarine scientists in the Australian Navy. But I often wonder, if you hadn't had that conversation, where would I be? 2-minute conversation. You know, and they're the ones that I only hear it sometimes, you run into them, or it's the ones that change the way they behave to other people because of a short, smart conversation, or you taught them how to be kind or thoughtful. So teaching is way more than what they're telling us about. And I could, you know, jump up and down on boxes about Julia Gillard's education revolution we can't have unless we care for them better.
Yeah. Well, look, Maggie, unfortunately, we're starting to run out of time. I want to play one of your last musical selections, and then I want to spend the few minutes we have left, because you not only have expertise in your work life, but you've also raised 4 young men of your own.
Spunks.
Well, well done there. Pat on the back for you. So I want to talk about this notion you have of breeding resilient kids, raising kids who have resilience as one of their tools that equip them with to lead life, I guess, in a successful and fulfilling way. So we'll have a quick listen to this song, and then we'll get back and talk about raising kids who are resilient in this very challenging new world we live in.
Let's go, girls.
Man, I feel like a woman, Shania Twain.
I'm in a poppin'.
The last musical selection of our guest this morning, Maggie Dent. Maggie, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and we haven't even covered your work in palliative care and as a funeral director's assistant and a qualified funeral celebrant and a wedding celebrant, and we could go on. But just briefly, your books are many. There are quite a few of them, but a couple, Saving Our Kids from Our Chaotic World, and your most recent one, Real Kids in an Unreal World. I'm a mother of young children. Just give me, in a nutshell, some advice on how to raise a resilient child.
Okay. We must remember that children are actually both incredibly vulnerable and also incredibly talented and gifted at the same time. Our job as parents is to guide and teach them, and we've become a world that wants to control them within an inch of its life. And I guess the overprotection of children is actually not allowing them to develop what I call competencies in terms of being resilient, able to know that, and I mean, a really simple example, Melinda, is we don't have any seesaws anymore because children hurt themselves on them. But I know that every single child who got hit in the chin by a seesaw knew how to respect that piece of equipment without
or came stomping down on their bum.
Yep, on their bottom. Mm. Now, you knew that hurt like heck, and you were careful of people jumping off, even though we all had someone we dropped on their bottom we didn't like, didn't we?
Mm.
So can you see what I'm suggesting to people, that children still need real experiences with dirt, trees, their own sense of fun, where we're not always hovering over them, because otherwise we're going to need to be hovering this sort of fake protection forever. And I want them to stand their own 2 feet at some point and not need to call mum and not need to be, you know, like, oh my goodness, what do I do next? I'm going to have a go at this myself.
Dispense with the cotton wool unless it's to put a bit of Dettol on a scraped knee.
And always try with a kiss first. You know, the kiss is, you know, unbelievable. And Band-Aids, you know, like, I just think there are some things children can actually learn. And I know this is a quick analogy, but if a man fell off a ladder as you're walking down the street, you don't run over, stand him up and say, are you all right? But we do that to children all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we run in and we kind of put them up and then go, are you okay? So we need people to pause a little and go, do you need my help? Are you okay with that?
Maggie, we have...
And how would you fix that?
We have run out of time, which is such a shame, but thank you very much for joining us. Maggie Dent, master of all things related to life, basically. Thank you very much for joining us.
And thanks, Melinda. People can go to my website and find all my bits and pieces.
This has been the Northern Territory Guest Room. Listen live each weekday from 11 a.m. Territory time, or go to abc.net.au/Darwin or /Alice Springs to hear more.